Have you heard the name Gaspé, the Gaspé Peninsula, and thought maybe it was out of your reach for a trip? Have you worried that your spay game isn't at a high enough level to hook a salmon? Maybe you just have no idea where to start on the journey to put together this trip. David Bishop is here today to give you the tips for success and three takeaways that are going to assure that you not only can do this trip, but you can have a chance at hooking an Atlantic salmon. This is the Wet Fly Swing podcast, where I show you the best places to travel to for fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species you love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing podcast. I've been fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I have also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about anyone in the world. Today, David Bishop is here to describe why fly speed is so critical and why faster and faster and faster is better and how to speed it up. You're going to know when to fish a dry fly versus a wet fly and the number one fly you likely have not seen. This is amazing, and we talk about it all today, how to get a fish to take on the surface. And we're also going to find out how to recognize a taker, how to spot one, and then how to get one to hook up. You're also going to find out why 6 and 8 pound tippets are what David recommends and how to activate your fly for success. We've got an epic OG from the Gaspé and beyond today. Here we go. David Bishop from AtlanticSalmonGuides.com. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing great, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on and doing an episode here. We're going to talk about a topic that we've covered before, and I think I never get tired of covering Atlantic salmon. I think mainly because it feels like it's a little bit like steelhead in some ways, and I also feel like it's also one of those species that a lot of people maybe want to do but haven't done. What do you feel like Atlantic salmon, how does it fit in the picture of all the other species? I'm guessing you fish for some other stuff. Do you feel like it's one of those that most people haven't done yet?
I think it's probably one of the more intimidating species for people because it is a species that is a very water-dependent fish, condition-oriented fish. They don't feed. Obviously, it's an adronomous fish. So when they do come back into fresh water, when we're actually fishing for them, it's quite a challenge. And so, you know, matching the hatch and fishing for trout and for other species like pike and bass and whatnot, you know, you have a really good chance at enticing a fish, you know, just through hunger. Whereas salmon and steelhead is pretty much a different game, especially with Atlantic salmon. You know, the success rate internationally is somewhere about, you know, one salmon per 3 days of effort. And I think it's probably the same thing for steelhead. Now, obviously, some places in the world, you can have much better success rates. Like here in the Gaspé Peninsula, we enjoy a very robust fishery in most of our rivers. But if you were to take it internationally, it can be a little bit tougher. And so it's a little bit intimidating for some people to move from a fish that's actually going to feed to one where no one really understands why they'll actually take a fly. Is it juvenile instinct? Is it aggressivity? Is it playfulness? There's so many theories out there that that's what makes kind of like this enigma of the Atlantic salmon.
Yeah, that's perfect. Well put. I think that the Gaspé, you know, we've done a few episodes from different parts on Atlantic salmon, both, you know, across the pond, you know, on that on the other side and here closer to the U.S. But it feels like, I mean, the Gaspé is one of those known names. Maybe it does, and I don't want to do the comparison game, but I feel like it maybe is, the fishing is a little bit better, like you're saying, up there. Does that mean that there's more catching, more size of fish, or what's that mean?
I think that, well, it really depends because we do have different profiles in different rivers. You know, a river is a living being, so it's an organism. So we have some rivers that are chock full of fish, but they're a little bit smaller. You have big grilse runs, grilse being a one sea winter fish. And then you have some rivers like the Cascapedia, where I base most of my operations and where I used to have my lodges. Is known for the extremely large genetic, very healthy genetic, very, very big fish, kind of like the Alta and let's say the Ristigouche. So there's basically three or four rivers that are known as big fish rivers. And in Quebec, that river is indeed the Cascapedia River. And right next door to it, you have a much smaller river called the Petite Cascapedia or the Little Cascapedia, which has a very small run, has very large fish. But very few of them. And then you go a little bit further east and you get to the Bonaventure River and you have a fairly robust salmon annual run, but the fish are really cookie cutter, you know, 10, 12, 14, 16 pounds. You get your occasional 20, maybe even 30 pound fish, but it's very rare. Whereas in the Cascapita, you have some years where my average is maybe over 22 pounds, 24 pounds. And then you have other, you know, just you go around the peninsula from within 2.5 hours from my house, I could be on 17 different salmon rivers. So I think the most important thing for people to consider is that the Gaspé Peninsula is the most accessible salmon fishing in the world. And there's absolutely no comparison. Europe, the UK, Russia formerly was all very exclusive, very high ticket. Whereas, you know, prices, whereas here in the Gaspé Peninsula, the Quebec government back in 74, 76, basically de-clubbed. They used to be all owned by clubs and by private interest. They basically expropriated everyone, gave it back to the provincial government and to the people. And they've come up with what's called a ZEC. In English, it would be a CEZ, would be a controlled exploitation zone. In French, it's a zone d'exploitation contrôlée. So basically, it's a democratic system where you have a draw system where 50% of the rods are allocated in a what we call the fall or the November 1st draw. And then the other 50% of those rods are allocated in a 48-hour to 72-hour draw during the summer. And then obviously, along with the ZEC system, which actually makes it the ZEC, is a number of those rods or the majority of the river is actually open to the public. So they're not reserve rod zones. So that actually allows anyone coming from the United States or from other parts of Canada to basically walk onto a river. You have to pay your daily access fee, but you don't necessarily have to have participated in the draw or have won the draw. It's actually a bonus if you do, because then you can choose to fish for a couple days, up to 3 days of fishing on a reserve rod zone, meaning limited number of rods. And so most people think, well, wow, that's the best water all the time. But that's not necessarily always true. There's a lot of the waters that are more public or the unlimited zones that can be can fish very, very well. It's just, like I said at the very beginning, I'm not sure if we were on live or not, but it's a very water-dependent fish. It needs cold water. Salmon need cold, well-oxygenated water. And when you have that in a good water level, you have fish that are very, very much easier to catch or much easier to entice to take a fly. When you get very warm, very low water conditions, the fish seem to pot up a bit more. They're much more lethargic, and your windows of opportunity are very early in the morning or right before dark. And so, you know, your chances of catching a fish are greatly reduced. You can have high water conditions in July as well as in August, just like you can in June. It's really kind of a weird thing, especially now with all the global changes in climate.
Yeah.
And we're finding, like last year, the best time of year last year was August. Whereas usually August is the time where, you know, it's the shoulder season, a lot less people are showing up. But last year it was gangbusters. So it's one of those things, if you watch the water levels, which are easily accessed through the internet now through the Quebec government, and you watch the weather patterns, and if you're able to just, you know, pack up and say, hey, I'm going this weekend because or next week because I know they're going to get a bunch of rain, if you're flexible, you can run into some great opportunities with very little angling pressure. Now, obviously,
that's really cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. It's I fished for steelhead as well, and steelhead are very similar.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, it's a water-dependent fish. And when I say water-dependent, it's mostly temperature and the actual height of the river.
Yeah. Yeah, that's perfect. I love this. And I think that it sounds like, you know, we did a recent episode to kind of Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, that area, the Margaree. And I think one of the take-homes was it's just, you know, you can get there a little bit easier than you can some of these other Atlantic salmon rivers, like, say, you know, up north, right, up into the Newfoundland and all that stuff. So it sounds like this is a pretty accessible place. Could somebody put together a trip and either drive or even fly in to fish the Gaspé? Is that doable?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I still have family that live down around Merrimack, Mass, which is, you know, right on the New Hampshire border, maybe 40 minutes north of Boston. And, you know, 8.5 hour drive, 9 hour drive max. You could actually fly from Boston or a lot of different places to Presque Isle, Maine, rent a car, drive 3.5 hours and be here. You can fly to Quebec City, take a really beautiful drive, 6 hours, be in the Gaspé Peninsula. And you have a bunch of rivers even prior to hitting the Gaspé Peninsula, you know, around Rimouski and other places. You can actually decide, I'm not going to fish the Gaspé and just go to the St. Lawrence, you know, the North Shore, the Lower North Shore. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of rivers here in Quebec, and there's dozens that I've never even fished.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. And then after that, you could tie it in with a trip down to New Brunswick. I mean, you know, for me to get to New Brunswick is an hour away. So it's pretty extraordinary in terms of the number of fishable water, the fishable rivers, I should say, and for the price. Because, you know, although non-residents usually will pay 50 to, let's say, double what a resident will pay, it's still very affordable fishing. We're not talking about thousands of dollars a day. We're talking, you know, a ticket costs anywhere from $60 to maybe $180 a day, Canadian funds, for a non-resident to come and enjoy, you know, a great day of salmon angling. You can't do that in the UK. You can't do that in Norway or Sweden, or perhaps maybe in some places in Sweden, Lapland. But, you know, it's the getting there and the cost of getting there. Here, you can basically a couple tanks of gas and you're here.
Yeah, this is awesome. I think you're painting the picture again. I think of a what I think is definitely a name, a famous place, but is doable. And when you look at it on the map, you see, you know, kind of the U.S. and Maine and New York. And we were just down in New York, and I'm sure, you know, it's a little bit of a drive, but even that you could probably drive, you know, from New York. You could probably fish for steelhead and maybe the same, you know, week fish for Atlantic salmon. I think that's kind of what's unique, because if you look at the Western U.S., other places, I feel like it's hard to get steelhead and Atlantic salmon. Have you ever done that before? Have you ever like had the two species? Do those overlap at all?
I've never done them in the same trip, but sure, I've made my way to, you know, Oswego County and fished there. I've fished out in BC, but, you know, I've got some friends that are real big steelhead anglers, you know, that live in BC that come here specifically early season to catch, you know, some large Atlantic salmon. They get it. They know the game. They know how difficult, you know, steelhead fishing can be, and also how crazy good, you know, 1 or 2 days or a week or two can be. And then all of a sudden, boom, it just goes back to being very difficult. Same exact thing with Atlantic salmon fishing. I mean, when the conditions are right and when you hit it right, it can be extraordinary fishing. When it's a little bit tougher, it's obviously just basic Atlantic salmon fishing, where you put your time in, you know, you have some chances, you have some fish that'll roll to your fly, that'll come to the fly. You know, you may not connect, but there's always something going on. And the sheer beauty of the Gaspé Peninsula and the fact that in the entire Gaspé Peninsula, the population is less than 100,000 people for the same geographical space of, let's say, you know, Massachusetts and Connecticut put together, comes to that, you know, it's pretty wild. Yeah. You know, there's some spots here where if you're willing to go off the beaten path, you can feel like you're totally alone.
That's great. That's awesome. Okay. So I think we're on track. I want to get into, you know, the trip itself, but let's bring it back real quick, because I don't want to miss your kind of background story. Give us a little rundown. Let's jump into your fly fishing, you know, real quick. How'd you get into it? What was your first kind of memory of fly fishing? And then how'd you bring it into like guiding and the lodges and all that?
Well, oh gosh, I'm a dual national. So I was born in Queens, New York, Jackson Heights. The age of 2 years old, moved to Connecticut with my dad and my mom. My mother is the Canadian; she's a Quebecer, and my dad is from Connecticut. And my first memories are with my father and my grandfather fishing behind Simsbury High School. With my dad with a fly rod, usually using worms for the very beginning, and then just kind of saying, I'm going to try this fly and having success, you know, basically just put it, you know, no casting, just kind of letting the fly, a picket pin going down and kind of like teasing it and boom, and having a brook trout come up. And then that kind of morphed into learning how to cast. And at a very young age, you know, 9, 10 years old, I was pretty proficient with the rod. Fly rod. And when I was about 11 years old, I befriended Mark LeBlanc, who is kind of one of my many mentors here, that would take me fishing. Wouldn't necessarily show me how to cast or how to fish, would just kind of take me to a place, and I kind of figured it out on my own. And that was mostly for a huge sea run brook trout, which is also another bonus that you can tag on to a trip here while you're doing salmon fishing. And then that morphed into, you know, Atlantic salmon fishing. My father was a devout fly fisher for salmon. He wasn't a fantastic caster or anything, but he was dedicated, and he actually spent 9 seasons without catching or landing a fish. And the first year he brought me was in 1974. I remember being in a canoe with him and a guide named Ray Cormier on the Petite Kaskapiti River. They were in the back of the canoe, kind of pouring something into their coffee that at the time I didn't understand right. what it was, lighting up a cigarette. And I made a cast and I rose a fish. And I didn't say anything. I was just like, oh my gosh, this big boil came behind my fly.
Oh, wow.
I looked back. I remember looking back at them and making another cast, and boom, I connected. Caught the first Atlantic salmon with my dad. And then the next day, I must have been his good luck charm, because the next day he caught his first salmon, and then it kind of morphed into, we just kept on fishing together. And
how old were you when you did that, David? How old were you when you got that first
fish? I was 10 years old. I was
10 years old. You got Atlantic. And was this an average size Atlantic salmon, small one, big one?
Yeah, it was about a 12-pound fish. It was a large pool on the Petite Kaskapiti River. I remember exactly where I was. I remember the whole scene. You know, there's certain things that impregnate into your young adult, your young self.
Well, 10. You're not even an adult. You're 10 years old.
I should say, when you're a kid. Yeah, that's one of my first great memories is that.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. If you catch one of those, and I remember my first steelhead was a little different than that, but my dad was there. And pretty much did that do it for you? Was that like you knew your life?
I was done. I was like done right there. At 14 years old, I started working at an Orvis shop in Simsbury, Connecticut, called Autumn and Greenleaf. And basically worked there right up until I went to college, and actually, brought some people with me to come and check out the Gaspé Peninsula. And this is a long time ago. This is before it was even, just as it was becoming public access. Before, you have to remember, all of the rivers here were owned by either rich Americans, rich Canadians, or clubs. The general public here in the Gaspé Peninsula or in Quebec did not have access to their own rivers. And then when the separatist government came into power, they basically just took everything back. Now, there was a couple of exceptions. Let's say on the Matapédia River, there was a few exceptions of camps. And on the Kaskapédia, there was some privileges given because there was a lot of lobbying going on. There was a lot of power and money. But for the most part, the rivers here were given back to the Quebec people. Their board of directors, each river is managed river basin by river basin. So it's not like you have the Quebec government that oversees it, but each individual region or town that has a fishery, they manage it by themselves under these guidelines that they need to adhere to. So you have to have X number of percentage of water that remains open to the public each day. Then, you know, how much you can charge, the minimum and the maximum that you're allowed to charge. So it's very well structured and very well run. And it's actually, they've had people from Europe coming and trying to see if they can adopt that in places like Norway and Sweden, because it is a very, very democratic way of allowing access to the rivers here.
Waters West Fly Fishing Outfitters is your go-to resource for swung fly techniques, two-handed casting, and anadromous fish. Find out why Waters West has built a cult-like following around their fly tying materials and why they are the go-to resource for the OP and beyond. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/waterswest right now to check in with Ed and Kyle and get all geared up to get on the water. Imagine yourself surrounded by pristine waters, towering mountains, and the thrill of landing a trophy fish like the majestic Arctic grayling or the elusive bull trout. Take a look for yourself at nradventures.com/wetflyswing and discover the Northern Rockies like never before. That's N as in Northern, R as in Rockies, adventures.com. You support this podcast by checking in at nradventures.com. No, it feels like that's pretty amazing because it gives everybody a chance. I mean, it's a lottery system, and a lot of places in the U.S. have done that. Like, not only fish, well, more I'm thinking the rivers, right? You get really busy rivers, you know, like rafting, boating, you got to have a lottery. The Grand Canyon's a good example. You know, I mean, some of those times you hear these stories that it takes years and maybe, you know, 10 years to get a permit. So that's the extreme. But I feel like it creates a better experience. And then some of these other places around the world, I guess you think of UK and some of these, you know, where it's pay to play. I feel like that, that's kind of the opposite, right? Why do you think those other, I'm not sure if you've ever fished across the pond Why do you think those other places haven't enacted something similar to this? Sounds like this has been pretty successful.
Well, I think it comes down to, it's always been a very elite sport, especially in the UK and some places. Like, you know, listen to, on the Alta, let's say, in Norway. I mean, there's people that buy, that have futures on there. They're basically on a waiting list. Yeah, for years and years. And they pay to have the opportunity of being next in line. Whereas in the UK, it's all owned privately. Whereas I don't think there was really the desire or the demand from the general population to expropriate. And I think that would have been a very complicated thing. Whereas here in Quebec, the political climate and, let's say, just the willingness of the government to listen to the people and to understand that their hunting lands and their fishing opportunities were all basically owned by private interests. And they just took it back. And it was ripping off a Band-Aid for the first few years or maybe decade. But once you got into the 80s, it was just basically that's how it was. And like I said, there are a couple of exceptions. So there was still some pay to play that was still left in place by the government. And, you know, it was justifiable because there was a lot of livelihoods that depended on continuing with the club system. Okay. And today is the same thing. We still have, you know, a number of privately owned clubs on the Cascapedia. They create, you know, dozens and dozens of jobs, and it's very appropriate because it allows a mix of public access and private access, and things work very, very well here. The First Nations population over the last 20 years have also said, hey, you know, this is actually our land, these are our rivers, and we want to have representation. And I've been involved in the last few years of doing some fishing, some exploration to see whether or not adding more rods, let's say, onto a certain part of the river would have a negative or a positive effect on the fishing angling experience. And we found that it did not have any negative impact. And so there's been more rods added that the First Nations Mi'kmaq of the Geskabigyag community have added to their portfolio in terms of, you know, their natural resources and how they manage them. And they do an excellent job. And so that creates even more jobs and more opportunities to fish for people. So I'm very proud to have been part of that. And I think that we're finding across the country here in Canada that there's some native, you know, First Nations, native populations that are saying, hey, we want to profit from the recreational fishery just as much as, let's say, the whites, and or I say non-natives. I mean, I want to be as politically correct as possible. Because, you know, basically here where I live, you know, the Geskabigyag community, the Mi'kmaq community is our neighbors. You know, one of my youngest sons goes to daycare on the reserve. My wife works on the reserve there. So it's very much part of our culture and very much part of our daily lives here. To live harmoniously together.
Yeah, I love it. I think that that's a really important part. And, you know, I think that, that's a great shout out there for sure. So I want to talk a little on, you know, the trip, like if you're setting up a trip, and we can get into some questions about kind of the fishing as well. But let's start there as far as if somebody's sitting here, you know, some listeners are like, oh man, I definitely want to do this thing. What's the starting point? Maybe tell us, you know, it sounds like you ran some lodges. What would be the best place? Like, what's timing? What's that look like?
Well, it really kind of depends on your budget profile, okay? If you want to do it, you know, do it yourself. And let's say you did not, you want to come this year. You're like, you know, I heard this podcast. I just want to go. You can, not a problem. You just have to understand that you have two ways of getting on the accessing the river, and not all the rivers, but most of the rivers. That would be either buying a daily access permit on the non-reserved water, do a little research.
Where do you find all this information about the waters? Is there a website or something where you can know where to buy them?
Yes, Saumon Quebec, Saumon, Quebec.com. Or .ca. I can't read it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. No problem. We'll find it.
Yeah, is probably the resource. So that's managed by the FQSA, the Fédération Québécoise de Saumon Atlantique, which is basically like the Atlantic Salmon Federation, but the Quebec version. And they basically encompass the promotion of the rivers. And so all of the draws, whether they be the November 1st draw or the summer draws, you can apply for them online. You can pay for them up front, say, hey, I'm going to come on this day. And if you win, well, then you have a, you know, you have an access permit opportunity for two anglers for one day each time that you win. And you can put in your tickets or your lottery tickets on a number of rivers. So let's say if you were here in the Bay de Chaleur, okay, the Chaleur Bay of the Gaspé Peninsula, which is the southern part of the Gaspé Peninsula, pretty much right in the middle, that would have four rivers. You have the Nouvelle River to the farthest to the west, the Grand Cascapédia, the Petite, and the Bonaventure. So you could put in, you know, I believe it's cost $7 per lottery ticket. Put your name in, and your partner could put them in. You can decide, well, I'm just going to put my name in for the Petite and the Bonaventure. If you win, great. You can have access to whatever water is available in those reserved or limited rod sectors. If not, you're like, hey, I'll just go onto the unlimited rod zone and I'll fish either the Petite or the Bonaventure, or I could even fish two rivers in one day. Because they're so close together.
They're so close. And yeah. What if we did this, David? What if we, you know, part of, we've talked a lot about this, you know, getting a guide. What if we plan on getting maybe a guide for the first day or two? Are there plenty of guides up there?
Well, it's funny because I actually started with myself, with Mark and Rajan, they're my two partners at the time, the very first guide company in Quebec in terms of private guiding for Atlantic salmon fishing. You know, that actually turned into us giving guide courses for a number of years. And now we're to the point where there are a plethora of guides. We were like basically the only trick in town for years and years. And then, you know, people started making a living off of guiding. And I'm proud to say that I've trained a bunch of folks. And I also have a bunch of, you know, friends that have started their own guide companies since.
Who would be, and I hate to, you know, kind of call out, leave anybody behind, but like if somebody wanted to find a guide, a good guide, what would be your recommendation, you know, that just to make the trip?
I have very, very few guides that I recommend personally because my reputation is pretty much
sure
built, and I do not want to ever give out information. I have a couple. People would have to contact me in private.
Yeah. Can they connect you? If people wanted to, can they connect you? We'll have you
look at the... I will give a shout out to a great new little company, some friends of mine. It's called Gaspé Coastal. And it's run by a friend of mine named Andrew Murphy, and his Atlantic salmon guide is named Alex Mallet. And Alex, you know, to be truthful, is probably one of the guys that I recommend the most. He's probably the guy that I recommend the most. There's also another operation called Falls Gully that has a great little, great young guide named Luc Harvé. There's a bunch of really keen younger guys out there that just eat, you know, breathe.
They're in it.
Salmon fishing, yeah. Yes. Then there's the older school guys that, you know, do their 8 hours. You know, they drive you around, you know, they'll put you on fish or put you into situations, but then there's the guys that are real fishy that I really like, you know, that'll put the 10, 12, 14, 16 hour day in and, you know, won't have their hand out at the end of the day, but would love, you know, love the appreciation at the end of the day, if that's in the budget to give a tip. And it's obviously, you know, it's pretty much standard that folks will tip people, but there are a bunch of people out there that, have gotten into this game, and some are great, some are still learning. I would not say that we have poor guides in the Gaspé Peninsula. We have guides that are either starting out or some that have a lot more experience. And, you know, it really comes down to personalities. You know, someone says, yeah, I'm expecting this. Well, then I'm going to put them with someone that I know that they're really hardcore. And then another guy's like, hey, I'm just coming for a nice mellow time with my wife or with my kid. I want someone to learn from. Then I'll mash them up with someone else. So it really comes down to, you know, knowing what the expectations of a future customer would be versus the people that I kind of know in my entourage.
Yeah, no, I hear you. No, that's great. And I know that's not easy to do, so I appreciate that. There's a few, and there's probably also some lodges. Is that something, could somebody like go up there and do the full lodge thing for a week?
Absolutely, yeah. Just like I was discussing earlier, my old lodge is called Salmon Lodge. That's owned by the owners of Camp Bonaventure. Those are private lodges. Private, public, I should say. They're public lodges. They don't necessarily have their own beats or water, but they do play the draws, and they do offer a beautiful place to stay, great meals, and very high quality guides that work for them. Most of those guides have been working for a long time. I'm happy to say that when I sold my lodge, they kept on most of those guides. The most recent, and I would say probably easiest way to get onto very high quality water would be to go through the two First Nations outfits. And the first one is the oldest one is called Mi'kmaq Camp. And the other one is the newest one called Plamugwet. And Plamugwet is the company that I worked with most recently. And let's say 22, 23 years ago, I worked with the gentleman, Guy Kondo, that opened the first native lodge on the Cascapedia called Mi'kmaq Camp. And so those are excellent lodges. They have their own water. You never have to go through a draw. You basically pay for a full boat. You're all inclusive. You're lodge fed guides. You're going back and forth to the river with your guides. You fish mostly a split day, which means you fish a 4-hour session in the morning, take a break, and then go back in the evening.
Yeah.
My son actually guides in the very upper part of the river where it's supposed to be a straight day because the distances are are so great. But he'll find himself doing split days because he's crazier than I ever was in terms of being a fish hawk. And he continues to do that to this day. In his summers. So there's some really great opportunities. Falls Gully, again, another company, Gaspé Coastal. Those are all companies where you can either get guiding or you can do the full boat. I know Gaspé Coastal will be building their lodge or renovating their lodge next spring, whereas Falls Gully has a great opportunity to people to either do the American plan, which means all inclusive, or a European plan, rent out a really nice chalet right on a trout pond or a trout lake, not very far away from the Bonaventure, the upper reaches of the Bonaventure.
That's awesome.
So yeah, there's some pretty unique opportunities. Now I'm only talking about my immediate area. If you start going more to the east, you have the St. John Pavilion, you have, a number of lodges on your way on the, either way, the Matapédia River is probably one of the most accessible rivers. That's to my west, about 45 minutes to an hour and a half, depending how high up you go on the river. Great access, very little limited water. It's almost all unlimited water. So you basically buy a ticket and you have like miles and miles of river to choose from.
That's amazing. Cool. So it sounds like there's lots of options here. What does it look like when you're on the water? We've talked Atlantic salmon. I kind of always think of the Spey as kind of like, it's taken over steelhead and, over a number of years now. But there are still some guys fishing Atlantic salmon with single. We talked to some people down on the Margaree. Now, is this more of a Spey game or is it like either one or what's that look like?
In the last, let's say, 25 years, when myself and a few other guys kind of introduced Spey fishing to this area, I actually had the opportunity to fish with Deck Hogan, which I know who
Oh, yeah.
Tom Perro wanted to do when he had wild steelhead and salmon. East Coast, West Coast guide meet one another and fish, one of each other's fishery. Well, Deck came out here with Spey rods and a bunch of the guys were like, what the hell is that? And then for a while, people were like, no, it makes too much noise on the water. And it was a real resistance to it. And now I would say that you probably have about 70% of the people fishing with double-handed rods versus single-handed rods, whereas 10 years ago, it was the total opposite.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, 25 years ago, no one was fishing. I mean, I was alone with a few other guys like Paul Caron and a few of the other guys. We were very, very, very few guys that were using double-handed rods.
This is awesome. Yeah, I love this. So there's still, and I feel like with the steelhead, I feel like it's even more. I think maybe it's more like a 90-10 or something like that, maybe even more. But so there's still a nice chunk. So why do people, especially because Atlantic salmon are so giant too, right? They're even bigger than steelhead, some of them. Maybe not in this area, but talk about that. Like why isn't it like 95% taken over completely?
Lee Wolf is basically the reason behind that. If you go back, 40, 50 years, he was the guy that actually started catching Atlantic salmon on a single hand rod, even, as short as 6-foot rods. Okay. So that basically, and also what was actually available to folks. There weren't many people that had access to double handed rods back in the 70s and 80s. Well, in this area, okay, 70s and 80s. It was basically in the 90s, early 2000s, where, folks started to you know, embraced. It was, they were more readily available. But you have to understand, people still fish a lot with single-handed rods because a 7, 8, or 9 weight, it gets the job done. You don't usually have to cast very far. Our rivers are not giant. So you can cover almost all of your water that you need to with a single hand rod. And when you're going to dry fly fish, which is a passion for a lot of anglers here, you don't use a spey rod. You use a single handed rod. So a lot of people, when I go hit the river, let's say when it gets into dry fly season, I have my double handed rod and I also have a single handed rod with me.
Yeah.
Always.
And that's and why is that? So that's, you have the dry fly. So with the spey, you could use a dry fly, but you're saying you, with the single, it just allows you more action. You can activate the fly more and things like that.
You can actually, it's a much more efficient, it's faster, and the hook set is much more accurate with a single-handed rod than it is with a double-handed rod. I mean, just the reaction time, just to be, you know, the ability to be able to change direction. Also, the amount of, let's say, noise that you make on the water, let's say a 7 weight line versus a 5'10 or 5'40 grain line, when it hits the water is a giant difference.
It is, right. So there is still some legit arguments for a single in certain situations, like especially, gotcha. Yeah. Okay, this is cool. So if you're going up there, I guess this is a good thing to know. So if you're going, let's go back to that. So we're going to get into the gear a little bit, but timing wise, I know there's a few different times. What would you say if somebody's, you know, again, I know there's probably a busy time and things, but what would be if we were going to put together one trip in this next year, and you know, what would it be? What would be a good time?
Well, I'll break it down by angler. Your hardcore spey guy who've been fishing for very difficult steelhead and have gone through multiple days of no catches or no hookups, but just loves being out there and wants to fish gin clear waters on some rivers and then some a little bit more mysterious water where you don't have necessarily the visibility and are willing to swing. Come early as you can in June, or back it up as far as you can into September, when the rivers come up, the river gets cold again, and now you're fishing. Now, the middle of the season, when the water warms up a bit more, is when you're going to get your best dry fly action. When the water hits around 50, 52 degrees to about 58, that is your sweet spot for dry fly fishing. Below that, below 50, 48, you know, you can still raise a few fish on dry flies, but they're not quite as curious. September, you can still catch fish right up to the end of the season with dry flies, but basically the best time would be from the very end of June right into August, through August into the beginning of September. So if you're more of, hey, I want to have lots of fish around, wait till July and August, September to fish, because that's when all the fish are in. If you want to like catch the fish that are coming in that are fresh, you may not have the numbers, but if you can find them and locate them, you're probably going to get a fish to take your fly. And also you're going to have a lot less competition. That was true up until about 6, 7, 8 years ago, until I guess myself and a few other guys started posting too many pictures of fish being caught very early in June. So now I enjoyed, you know, 25 years of catching fish, you know, the first week of June with no competition. And then, you know, brought a few guys, brought a few clients, and then, you know, word kind of gets out. Guys become savvy. You know, I'm not the only guy that explores. So then, you know, other guys start exploring, then they make their friends, then they have their clients, and then it just kind of spirals out of control.
Yep.
We're into a peak right now in Atlantic salmon fishing here in Quebec, especially because of the efforts of a few different companies. One in particular, which would be Houquet, who is a film company that documents and promotes fly fishing and the accessibility. Fly fishing has become really cool for the 20, 30-year-olds, okay? And we've seen this giant, giant surge in the interest, the number of couples that fish, the number of ladies that fish, the number of women now that fish, because of the 50-50 on the water and just other initiatives is crazy. And it's awesome to see because you'll see gals going out, you know, all together. Whereas, you know, before it would be like, well, I'm going to go out with my boyfriend or my husband. And now it's like, screw that. We're going out. We're going to have a great time. And they're catching fish and they're awesome. And there's some great guides as well. Sarah Nellis, who's the partner of Andrew Murphy of Gaspé Coastal is a great example. Girl, local girl from Cascapedia, got her feet wet with the industry and just performed, skyrocketed in terms of being very fishy, very knowledgeable. And so now we have folks, both genders, that can take people out and introduce them to the sport. Lynn Sexton started 50-50 on the water here in Cascapedia a number of years ago. I mean, she gets 120, 130, 140 people each May, women that come from all over the place, New York, Nova Scotia, Quebec, Ontario, and they all come to learn. And then a bunch of us guides and other people help out. And a lot of other guides, younger guides, are helping a lot more than I have recently. But, you know, we give casting lessons or teach people how to do knots. And we go through basically a full weekend of introductory to fly fishing and focus on Atlantic salmon. And now we have, you know, all sorts of companies and people out there that are promoting the sport. The only reason that's possible is because Quebec is so accessible. If this was, you know, another province that didn't have as much accessibility and everything was private, you just wouldn't have this this newfound love for a sport that's super accessible.
Yeah. Yeah, this is great. No, I love, I mean, there's always going to be some, you know, the bad, the good, even this podcast, right? So we're getting some new people are going to be probably heading up that way. But I feel like, you know, you probably, I'm sure maybe see a little bit of this, that more people, right, it's more pressure, but those people are into eventually conservation and protecting the species. Do you see that over the last 10 years up there too, where more people are into it?
Absolutely.
And they're more actually conserving more?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, trying to get someone to do catch and release here was, I used to have to walk into some of the meetings when I would suggest it with my guides, you know, by my side, because people wanted to just like, hey, you're going to take something, you're going to take away our right. Which it is a right. And I would listen, in the perfect world with perfect salmon stocks, I would love nothing more than to be able to take one fish home to my table. Especially if it was a kid who I was introducing for the first time, catches his first fish, he or she catches their first fish and brings it home. I mean, what a feeling that was for me when I was 10 years old. I mean, it's indescribable. Today, it's not possible. Unless you're catching grills, which you're still allowed to keep on most rivers here. You know, we would love to see total catch and release, but there is a timing to everything. There's an acceptance by people, but I would say in the last 10 years, due to the efforts of a lot of these film companies and a lot of the people that are involved today, people aren't looking to buy to kill salmon. They're looking to, and especially the people that have businesses now, a live salmon is worth a lot more than a dead salmon.
Yeah, that's right.
And so yes, the younger generation has embraced catch and release and the ecological and basically the conservation side of things.
Today's episode is sponsored by Togan's Fly Shop. Togan's Fly Shop provides superior quality products at a great price. They have also a great YouTube channel that you can check out right now with new fly tying tutorials each week. Togan's also has you covered if you're looking for unique in-house products, and they also support many of the great brands out there that you know and trust. Togan's is also offering their fly tying box, where they send out materials at a regular cadence where you don't even have to think of it. You just open the mailbox and there's your Togan's pack. And I recently made an order through Togan's and the experience is always perfect. They've got you covered if you ever have questions or need any help, whether that's a YouTube tutorial or connecting with them personally. Since 2005, Togan's has been over delivering on customer service. And it's time for you to check out Togan's Buzz for yourself. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/Togan's right now to check out their diverse selection of products today. You support this podcast by clicking through that link to Togan's online. That's Togan's, T-O-G-E-N-S. Imagine embarking on a journey to Alaska, that ultimate destination for adventure seekers. With Fishhound Expeditions, this dream can become your reality. Picture yourself amidst the wild Alaskan landscape, where the northern lights dance across the sky and you're reeling in some of the biggest rainbow trout you've ever seen. It's an experience that feels like a dream, but with Fishhound, it's an adventure waiting to happen. If Alaska is on your bucket list, Fishhound Expeditions is the key to unlocking that dream. Visit fishhoundexpeditions.com today and mention that you discovered them through this podcast. That's F-I-S-H-H-O-U-N-D, Expeditions. Don't just dream about Alaska, experience it with Fish Hound. Let's get in a little bit here on just the dry fly fishing versus, say, other techniques. Like, if you're out there and you mentioned June through September, let's say you're in there in that period where maybe the water is not quite warm enough to feel the dries. Or when do you know, when do you switch in from like a wet fly over to the dry fly?
That basically comes down to if you're fishing a river where you have, you know, sight fishing. So you have to understand, we have two basically types of river. We have rivers here that are, when I say gin clear, you can see a, you know, a half dollar at 10, 15 feet, whether it's heads or tails, okay? It is that clear. Wow. The Bonaventure River, the Petite Cascapedia, the St. John, the Nouvelle are gin clear rivers. It's all sight fishing, or almost all sight fishing if you know how to look for fish. Whereas the Cascapedia, the Matapedia, the, you know, the Dartmouth, the York are a little bit more colored or stained. So it's a little bit more faith fishing. So if you're over a bunch of fish, let's say in a tail out, and you see them and you're not getting the action on your wet fly, you may just start, you know, chucking a few dry flies and see if you have any reaction. If you do, then you know you're onto something. Okay. I would say that that cutoff point's around 50 to 52 degrees for optimal dry fly fishing opportunities. I have caught fish at 46, 47 degrees, basically really fresh, horny fish. But besides that, I would stick to the general rule of over 50, below 60. That's where you're going to really get your best dry fly opportunity.
Over 50, below 60, yep. Okay, so you have that. And then if you're not fishing dries, what's a typical style? Maybe talk about the setup for just fishing. If it's not dries, how would you be doing it?
I would probably in, you know, June, let's go break it down by month. Higher water, June, I'm fishing very large flies. I'm fishing anything from, you know, a size two to maybe a 3.0 fly, you know, three-aught, mostly in the one, you know, a 1-aught, 1.5, if you're using an Alec Jackson hook.
And these are traditional, so you're talking fishing, swinging traditional, like traditional salmon flies.
Yeah, so like, you know, one of my favorite go-to flies, I love black. I mean, black is black. I'll fish anything as long as it's black. So,
yeah,
you know, a John Olin Longwing, a Picasse, which is, you know, a little bit darker, but it has some yellow in it. My personal favorite fly, and you can get all this off of my website, okay? I have a blog called If I Had a Nickel series, and I'm super honest. I mean, my go-to fly is the Paul Carone Stonefly. It's called the PC Stone. It's a takeoff of Lee Wolf's original Stonefly pattern. It's tied several ways. The way that I tie it or the way that I fish it is with a natural post, meaning the wing being bucktail, very, very soft bucktail, is made into a post, and then you take your hackle and you wrap it in a parachute style that way around it, okay? There is another style where they use a pin, where they actually crimp the pin so that it has a, you know, a 90 degree angle pointing straight up. It makes it the fly much heavier, and I don't necessarily want my fly to sink. I want my fly to either skim just below the surface, or if I speed it up, skim on the surface, or if I slow it down, be a little bit more subdued under the water. But it's got a fluorescent green body, a black wing, and basically a badger hackle. End of story. Super simple. If I grease it up, I can even use it as a dry fly if I want to. So it's my number one fly, followed by the John Olin Longwing, the Picasse on a gray day or a rainy day. You know, every once in a while, I have another fly that I invented when my son was born a long time ago, called the Dillon Spey. There's a Dillon Spey and a Dillon Dark Spey. Those are two flies that I go to a lot, especially the Dillon Dark Spey. I absolutely have great success on that. But to be quite honest with you, if a fish is going to take a fly, he's going to take anything you throw in front of him, as long as it's swung the right speed. So, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, this is the best fly, or this is the best fly. You know, guys are still, I know guys that are still fishing silver rats and rusty rats, which is the first fish, you know, the fly that I caught my first fish on was a rusty rat. So it really comes down to the speed of what you, you know, how you present your fly. Fly presentation is 90% of the game. Fly selection is about 5% of the game, and luck is about 5% of the game.
Yeah. So fly presentation is a big part of this.
Fly speed, fly speed, fly speed. I tell everyone, fly speed. And you cannot swing a fly fast enough in June to my liking.
Oh, really? Yeah. So fly speed. So how do you increase the fly speed? Like, talk about the gear you're using to increase that fly speed. Or how are you doing it?
Well, first of all, I fish almost exclusively with floating lines. And so with a floating line, I can manipulate my fly speed much better than I can with a sink tip or a sinking line. Okay. It comes down to physics. I have less resistance on the water with something that's light. So then I can manipulate by a downstream end or increasing my angle rather than casting 45, casting 60, 70 degrees to the current, and even mending downstream to really let that thing rip across. Also comes down to the type of current you're fishing. Are you fishing an inside seam? Are you fishing a tail out? Are you fishing something that has, like, you know, different currents that are evolving due to structure, boulders or whatnot? So basically, I'm fishing my spots and I'm trying to present the fly usually two ways. I'll hit my basically 60 degree angle and just let it go. If I get something that's coming after my fly or miss, you know, that boils at my fly, I'm going to speed that fly up. I'm not going to slow it down. That's the first thing that people do. Cast, mend up. Most guys cast, mend up, cast, mend up, cast, mend up. Whereas me, I rarely mend up. And if I do, I'm usually going to throw another mend on it somewhere in my swing down to speed up my fly. So I'm actually going to make two casts and then my step, because I'm going to cover as much water as possible. I don't want to just continually cast in the same spot, hoping there might be a fish there. Steelhead fishing is different. Steelhead actually move a lot. Salmon, once they hit a lie, they're going to stay on that lie for quite a while, up to days or weeks. Whereas, you know, sure, if they come into the tail of the pool, you see it come in, they may move up to the head of the pool or blow right through into a different pool. But if you get to a place where there's 10, 12, 15 fish that have been there for a day or two, they're pretty much going to stay on those same lies, unless it's really warm, and then they're going to move around depending on where the oxygen is. But if it's pretty cold, they're going to pretty much hold, you know, where they came into that pool. Yeah. So I experiment, you know, take one or two casts, take my big step or a couple steps down, and I just want to cover water. I want to find a taking fish. I would much rather fish over, you know, fish 2-3 kilometers in a day and maybe try to get a fish that's going to be the taker rather than fish, you know, 300 meters in a day, continually going back and forth, you know, continually hit the same fish, just, you know, going through the pool. I just want to find that taker. And I think that's a big mistake a lot of people do, is they concentrate on numbers of fish rather than finding that fish that's going to take the fly.
That's amazing. And to find that fish that you've talked about, some of it here, maybe most of it, but remind us again, how do you find that? That if you can't, let's see, if you can spot a fish, I see how you could do that. But like, what if you're in those waters where you can't see as well? How would you find the taker?
Well, my style of fishing, okay, there's a lot of people that just drive to pools, walk into a trail and, you know, fish the pool, go out to another, you know, I take a canoe all the time. When I guide, I never, ever do, you know, walk and wade, because first of all, I'm not offering a value to someone that could just do it themselves. I mean, I'm basically, right. why would I bring my clients to somewhere they can drive to and get into a Congo line or sure. do some rotation with other anglers. So I'm bringing them down in a canoe. I'm finding fish if I can, you know, see them. If I'm fishing in like the Bonaventure, the Petite, I'm looking for fish. I'll go miles without even stopping the canoe. The guys would be like, hey,
oh, wow.
And I tell people before they come, you know, listen, if they come super early in the year, you may have a great canoe ride. You may not fish all that much. And if they're like, hey, we just want to swing. Sure. Cause I could miss a fish. It's possible. If I'm going to fish the Cascapedia, I know the water so well and I know where the fish should be. Even if I can't, I don't even look for the fish, because the fish there are lots more spooky. It's probably by the fact that, yeah. you know, you can get so close and boom, you can't see them and they go off. Whereas, you know, when it's really clear, you see them from a distance, and so you're not gonna really float over them. So I will fish my spots, and, you know, once I put the two anglers through and there's no action, unless I'm certain that, you know, they didn't fish it properly, I won't go through a second time. I'll just keep on going and I'll cover as much water as I can early in the season to try to find those fish that are not, you know, just apparent. And if I get lucky as I'm coming down river and I see maybe a fish roll, you know, before I get down to it, I'm like, okay, now I know we have a really good chance here because these fish are active. They're on the move or they just came into the pool. And then I know kind of in my mind, all right, I'm going to concentrate a little bit longer over these fish or over this pool. And then, you know, once I've completed, I'm satisfied with that. We covered the fish with a couple different flies. Okay, I'm good to go. I was saying flies, not necessarily important. Fly size can definitely have, can definitely be important. I didn't want to necessarily say that flies aren't important. It's the size of the fly can be very important.
Yeah.
Especially when the water's low, super small flies. When the water's higher, much larger flies. So color is, you know, color at a certain time of the day is a moot point. You know, when the sun goes down, fish are seeing shades. They're not seeing color. It's only on a really bright day or if the water is very, very stained or you know, in spate coming up and, you know, it's really brackish, are fish going to see color. And black is the thing that stands out the most. We tend to think that white is something that's going to stand out the most. Black is actually what stands out the most to any fish.
Mm, yeah. So the black.
Yeah. Fish see the fly from underneath looking up. Okay. So the biggest contrast with the skyline is going to be the darkest color, not the lightest color.
Right. Is the darkest. There you go. So that's awesome. That's, and then, and going back to that PC, and it's Paul, is the Paul Caron stonefly?
Yeah. Paul Caron stonefly. That's what we call the PC stone.
PC stone.
There's a bunch of different stories behind the where it came from, but my buddy, Paul Caron, tied this version of the stonefly that is killer. It's just absolutely killer. Yeah.
And that wing, like the parachute, it's almost like basically a parachute Adam style, right?
It's exactly the same thing. I think there's a combination of things. The profile of the fly and the high float of the fly, I think that there's a vibration that comes off of that that hackle. As long as it's a good, high-quality, dry fly hackle and not like, you know, a soft hackle that you would use for a throat. I think for me, if I'm going to like nitpick about what's important on that fly, is that you use the proper material. And just the way that it moves, I've probably caught in the last 15 years, 85% of my fish on that fly. And probably because I fish it 85% of the time, to be quite honest with you. But it is that fly that just seems to do it for me. And so I have a lot of confidence. And it's very important that you have confidence in your fly when you're fishing.
Love that. Yeah, no, it's such a cool fly. That's one we haven't seen. And I mean, that would probably work in plenty of other places, you know, around the world. So is the waking style, is that something that's not fished as much? Is it more like the dead drift style up there?
Basically we always have tension on the line. The patent method is actually how we do catch a lot of fish when we cast and the fish takes right away. People don't realize that the fly is just fluttering down. It's not actually having any resistance. You know what the patent method is, right?
No, I don't.
Well, the patent method is basically free floating a fly wet. So it's almost like a nymphing of a fly, if you will. And it happens naturally. When you cast and your fly hits the water and plops on the water, there is a time before actually your line comes taut, which is called the patent method. Yeah. So, you know, you'll fish and you'll cast across a current into, let's say, an edge where there might be some fish. And a lot of times, right as that line comes tight, boom, the fish will take. But they've been watching that fly, you know, float. And all of a sudden the fly goes, whoop, it's starting to go away from them. Well, it's stronger. It's an instinct. I want to go and catch that thing. Whereas a dry fly drift, okay, is a dry fly drift. I think the patent method would be more just fishing it without really knowing wet.
Like you said earlier, not trying to do a upstream end or downstream end. You could really just make your cast and then just let it swing down.
Just let it swing. So the first part of the drift is kind of be just drifting naturally. And then all of a sudden your line's going to come taut because of the current. And then now you have friction and now you have a fly that's actually tracking way behind your fly line. So that's what people don't understand is they're watching their fly line thinking that's where their fly is. Their fly is probably anywhere from 6 to 12 feet behind it. You know, but not necessarily straight down behind it, but actually across the river where they actually cast.
Right.
And also, you know, like steelhead fishing, you need to let that fly swing to the end of the drift, especially in June. Okay. Whereas I'll be honest, that's something that I get impatient. I just want to make my next cast. So I don't do it that often, but I miss fish that way. So I really have to focus, okay, I need to allow my fly to swing right to the end, because steelhead are famous for taking on the dangle. And salmon will also quite often take on the dangle. We just don't realize how many times that we could have caught a fish because we've already started stripping back 10, 15 feet before that fly has actually stopped swinging.
Yeah, gotcha. And over back to the spay. So when is the time you're switching over and fishing like a spay? And then what is the spay like length and line you're using there for the spay stuff?
So I'm using generally a 12 and a half foot, let's say 450 to 510. That's my sweet spot. I like a 480, you know, pretty much 12 and a half, 480 or 450. I use a very long leader compared to a lot of guys. I'm always using 15 to 20 foot leaders, 15, let's say 17 foot leaders. I like to fish very small tippets unless I'm fishing a very big fly. I always use the proper tippet for the size of my fly. A, to turn it over, and also for the fly to be able to track properly. If I'm using a small fly with too large a tippet, I'm not going to get any action from that fly. I use a double turl knot, or I used the Duncan loop, depending on how much I want that fly to swim, okay, or to have, you know, motion to it. I'll fish up to, like, early June when the water's really big, I'll fish up to a 14-foot rod, mostly 13 and a half foot rods. Now I'm getting to my 540. Like I said, I don't fish a lot of skagit lines or sinking sip-tint lines, but it does happen, especially if, you know, the conditions really are not conducive to let's say, a floating line. Hover lines I'll use, intermediates I'll use, but I'm usually fishing most of the time with a floating line. Between that 12 and a half to 13 and a half foot rod is the sweet spot. And then a lot of people are fishing switch rods when you get into the July, August time period, when the water's a little bit lower. A lot of guys are fishing switch rods. I enjoy a switch rod. My wife feels very comfortable with a switch rod as well. And it's also something that you can use a little bit easier for dry fly fishing, so you don't necessarily have to carry two rods with you.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about the switch is that essentially, I think it is a switch rod if you can cast it right single hand without too much effort all day. That would be, so that'd be more like what, like an 11,
11, 1, 11, 6 max. Yeah. Somewhere around there.
Yeah, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. So you got that. And then the leader. So, and what would you be your leader? Like if it was 15 feet, is this like one straight diameter? How would you do your leader?
No, contrary to what most people do with their single hand or their double, I always have tapered leaders. I mean,
yeah.
The importance of tapered leaders is a whole nother podcast. I mean,
yeah, okay.
I won't get into it. That's my pet peeve. Yeah. When people show up and I look at, the first thing I do is I look at their setup and I'm like, this is not right.
Well, tell us this, David, because we could follow you up. Give us a heads up again on your website, because I'm sure you have a blog post. Do you have something that talks about your tapered leader?
No, but that will be another one of my blogs. But I do have, like, you know, if I had a nickel for every time someone asked me what's the best fly, it all comes down to what time of the year. That's totally on my site. I think I talk a little bit about leaders, but just me personally, you know, and if you talk to any real proficient caster, the importance of a tapered leader is unbelievably important.
Yeah. Yep. Tapered. So, and then what would be your, if you're fishing like on the tippet, like let's take it to that fly, the PC, the stone, I'm guessing that can be, what would be the biggest? Is there a wide range of size that you use, or is there one typical size?
Yeah, you can, I mean, I fish it up to 1.5. So 1.5,
oh, wow.
I'm probably using a 15-pound leader. So I don't know what the diameter is, but when I get down to size 7 or 9, I can tell you that I'm fishing 6-pound test, you know.
Oh, you are? 8. Yeah, 6-pound.
Oh, yeah. One of my biggest fish I ever caught was on 6-pound test on a trout rod.
That's it. And the advantage there is that, like you said, sometimes the opposite. Again, we've been doing the steelhead comparison. But you go up to the Skeena, like you were talking to those guys earlier, and they're fishing whatever, 20-pound test. But the difference is here, you really want that action. That's the key on the fly. Is that the reason why the 6-pound or 8-pound is better?
I want the supple, very small tippet to allow that fly to do its magic. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
Perfect. Good. Well, you know, like a lot of these, we always, I think, feel like we touched the surface. I think we'll definitely have to follow up with you and keep you in touch. But let's do our shout out segment, and then we'll take it out here with a few random ones and give people a few more tips here. But this one's to Andrew Horton. So Andrew was on a trip, actually, our nymphing school last year, and he's from Quebec. And it was interesting because Andrew talked about how unique Quebec is. I really think it's really, we don't get into politics here, but it sounds really interesting. It sounds like they're doing some cool stuff. And Andrew was an awesome guy. So shout out to Andrew. Hopefully we're going to see him on another trip. But tell me this, what is, you know, we talked about a few things, the canoe. Let's just start there. Boat-wise, why the canoe? Why not raft, drift boat, anything like that?
Simple, short answer, tradition. Yeah, tradition and practicality. First of all, when you're coming down, if you were to come down in a raft, your oar length is, you would just make a lot of unnecessarily noise. And also the size of the rivers. Traditionally, we've been using either a 26-foot or 24-foot cedar strip canoe. I basically now have switched over to an ABS 20-foot canoe just because it's much faster, much lighter, much easier for me to get around. However, it depends on which river I'm fishing. If I'm fishing the branches of the Kaskapiti River, I've got my 20-footer. Because I can't put in a 26-footer. I just can't put it in or take it out. If I'm fishing the Bonaventure River, I'm usually going to use my big canoe because I have more room. I have much better put-ins and takeouts, which I'm not going to break my canoe. And it's the traditional way of doing things. People tried a few times to throw some cataracts and some things here. They just weren't really well received, and people don't want to, to rock the boat, and it's just not very practical. Yeah, it's just not practical.
So that's it. And on the water, are you going to see lots of guys in the tweed hats and all that stuff, like traditional style? No.
No, you'll see a few guys maybe coming over from across the pond, but most guys are, it's your exact same profile of Skeena angler. I mean, from your, from your dudes to, fathers and sons and, fathers and daughters, couples.
Right. Yeah. The whole thing.
Yeah. The whole thing, people that are there with, a bunch of friends, a few couples together.
Yeah.
It's a very friendly community, and it's a very respectful community. It's very, very rare that you are going to have any strife or any problems on a river here in Quebec.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And I love the canoe. I think it definitely, like you said, it's just different. It's kind of a different thing. It's the experience. And we all know that, especially if you're only going to get potentially a fish over a day or three, that, it's all about the whole thing. And I've never fished for Atlantic salmon with a canoe or steelhead either, right? And then 26 feet too is a gigantic. Is the reason for the big length of the boat just to have more gear or more people? Or why not make it, could it be a shorter length, like say a 15-foot canoe?
No, but basically let's go to camp style fishing, okay? Well, you have a head guide and you have an anchor. So you have two guides in the boat and then you have two clients in the boat. So you need 26 feet to be able to support that. Whereas myself, I'm guiding independently. So I'm the only guy in the canoe. So I'll be in the back of the canoe or the bow of the canoe, which is pointing upriver, and my two clients will be in front of me and I'll pole down. Then there's some people on some rivers are allowed to use 9.9 motors, okay? Up to a 9.9 is allowed on certain rivers, certain sectors of rivers. And when the water's high, it's just a great way to get around, quickly and easily. And then there's some rivers that zero canoes are allowed. Like you go to the, the York and the Dartmouth, people aren't on canoes. It's all walk and wade. Or very rarely. There's a couple of beats on the York River where you it's a big advantage to have a canoe. But in most of the places, there's canyon water. It's very difficult. You couldn't navigate it with a canoe. There's only a couple sectors. And then there's other rivers where you just have no access to use a canoe. We're lucky here on the Petite, the Bonaventure, and the Grand Kaskapedia, or the Kaskapedia is actually what it's called, to be able to use our 20-foot or even 26 or 24-foot cedar strip canoes or the 20-foot ABS canoes.
Gotcha. This is great. Nice. And let's just take it away here with our kind of just some takeaways today. If we covered a lot. I think some of it we didn't go super deep, which is great because that means maybe we'll follow up with you. But what would be the three takeaways for you maybe from today or just somebody that's thinking like, man, they want to do this trip. What would you be making sure they take away before they, either when they're before on the water or when they're on the water?
Well, before they're on the water is to not be intimidated by the fact that this is salmon fish, Atlantic salmon fishing in Quebec. First of all, today's environment, today's climate, people are super, super friendly, even if you don't speak French. Mm. It goes a long way if you can just learn how to say please and thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
Smile. And I think that that fly folk, fly fishing folk, are a little bit more in tune with being polite and understanding those things. So is to really come into it where don't be intimidated. It's just another fishery. It's super accessible. It's 100 times more accessible and easier than you think it's going to be. That's one. Two, once you're here, or while as you're planning, there are a plethora of places to stay, whether it be a hotel, whether it be chalets owned by, you know, a river association, campgrounds, Airbnbs. You're just going to find generally that, you know, you can stay right on the water on the bay and fish for striped bass after your fishing session.
Oh, wow. Or,
I mean, nice. Our striped bass fishing here, that's a totally another subject, is off the hook, man. It's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. So, you know, the salmon fishing sucks. Okay, let's just go fish for striped bass or whatever.
Brook trout.
You know what I mean? Or I had a great morning. I caught my two fish. I released them. I don't feel like quitting fishing. I'm going to go and, you know, play a tide and go do it. So that's another thing, is you have multiple species. You have trout as well. And then your gear, you know, you come up. Don't spend like, you know, you're, well, unless you're into this type of thing, really tying a whole load of flies getting ready for this trip. Come up with a few flies and just go to the local fly shop, find out what's working, buy a half dozen or a dozen flies, and you're done.
Yeah. So it sounds like keeping it simple, because I think people, the gas
don't
bay,
overthink
people think,
it.
Oh, yeah, don't overthink it. Just come up there and just have a good time.
You don't want to overthink this. I mean, I have hooked up hundreds of people in the last, you know, oh my gosh, you know, 40 years on how to come and do this trip. And if you just go onto the website, it's super easy. And you go to Saumon Quebec website, it is all laid out for you. It tells you which rivers, you know, every river has their own like little page and tells you, it shows a river map. You know, some rivers are busier than other rivers. Okay. And, you know, I would say some of the sleeper rivers right now would be like the Madeline River, which is on the northern shore of the Gaspé Peninsula. That river doesn't get fished hardly at all, and that's got tons of fish in it compared to the Bonaventure, which I would say, if you're going to come to the Bonaventure, you need to either come late September or mid-September to maybe really early June, which is really not a great time because fish come in a little bit later. But if you come in July, be prepared to be fishing with a lot of people.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, well, it sounds like there is some, obviously, like any new place, some research, and you would be a good resource. So if people are listening and they wanted to pick your brain either on Instagram, they can check in with you?
They can check in with me. They can check in me through my website. You know, I have another job as well, so I do try to get back to absolutely everyone. But I would say peruse the website a little bit, my blogs. And if you have questions after that, specific ones, not a problem. I'm super happy to help out. I don't really take that many guide gigs anymore. I do about 25 to 35 days. I've been guiding the same people for years. I rarely take new clients, but it does happen. But I do have, there is, like I said, a whole new crop of guides out there that you can hook up with that I'll be happy to refer to, or you can probably just find them online. And they're excellent. You know, you'll find your way. You'll find your way.
Yeah. That's perfect. And it's Atlantic Salmon Guides with an S.com, right? That's the best place?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Perfect, David. All right. I think we'll leave it there until the next one. Definitely appreciate all your knowledge. And this has been awesome. I think just digging in. I love the comparisons today because we talk spay, single hand rod, we talk steelhead, Atlantic salmon, and just I think it's a fun conversation to have. So yeah, appreciate all your help today and look forward to keeping in touch.
Absolute pleasure. Stay well.
Woo! There you go. I think that was pretty much overload, which is what we all love. I think we're definitely going to have to do a follow-up with David. Maybe we'll bring some of his protege on the show in the future. I think we're definitely going to follow up and maybe even put together a trip out here. If you're interested in a trip, send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com. I'd love to know if this is something you want to do. And if you do, just say Gas Bay in the subject line of that email, and I can work to put together this trip, and I would love to hear what people want to do and what would be best. Like we said, we've got these trips going all year long and all around the world. We've got mostly North America right now, but we're going to be expanding out. You can go to wetflyswing.com/school right now and find out what trips we have going. You can also go to wetflyswing.com/live if there's a live event right now and find out and enter to win one of these trips. We got these going all year long as well, but I'm going to get out of here because I got a bunch on my plate today. So I just want to wish you a happy morning, a happy afternoon, or a happy evening wherever you are in the world. And I appreciate you sticking around all the way to the very end today on this podcast. And I'm excited to catch up with you on the next one.